This feature has been brought to you by Slot Foundation, which needs your support to continue projects like these. Information on this recording and access to other recordings is available online at slot.org.
We are very pleased to start our season, if I may say so, and we're extremely glad to have William Anastasi with us. The occasion of this evening is the publication of this neat little book that came from a conference we had a year and a half ago. By a great coincidence, it happened that today there's a word and image conference that has started in Philadelphia, which gave us the great piece of luck to have Mia with us. And I'll just say a few words. She will introduce William Anastasi's work, and Krista Maria, or Mia Lum-Hayes, has been responsible for this wonderful book that is called Joyce in Art, and that was this is a catalog with lots of essays from an exhibition she curated in Dublin, and in which much of what you those of you who've seen the exhibition by William Anastasi, is a part of it was reproduced at least on one wall, and it's a really lovely, lovely book, Joyce in Art. Let me just say a few words about her. She is a lecturer in historical and theoretical studies in visual arts at the University of Ulster Schools of Art and Design in Belfast, and she has a PhD from Cologne University, and she has published many essays, art criticism, and a book on Joseph Beuys in German, and of course, and she is working curating both in Belfast and in Dublin. So it's a great honor to have her present William Anastasi.
Thank you so much for your kind words and the invitation to come here this afternoon. William Anastasi's Pataphysical Society, Jarry, Joyce, Duchamp, and Cage is a remarkable book. It gives testimony to William Anastasi's four-decade-long occupation with Alfred Jarry and what one could call a core group feeding off Jarry, Joyce, Duchamp, and Cage. William Anastasi's Pataphysical Society is also, as this evening's proceedings illustrate, a society, and one I can assume, or I know, that enjoys increasing popularity. In the introduction, the editors Jean-Michel Rabaté and Aaron Levy call the aim of the microscopic research that Anastasi has undertaken and continues to pursue an elucidation of exponentially multiplying networks of correspondences, echoes, allusions, quotations, and borrowings. These correspondences are between motifs, procedures, and characters' lives, or authors, artists' lives. In Anastasi's case, this dense web has Alfred Jarry at its center and has widened over the decades to include not just Joyce Duchamp, but Cage and others, thus Anastasi's contemporaries and friends. This ever-widening circle has now encompassed what I would call the society to which the book's title alludes. In the readers' and protagonists' minds, those of affiliates of the society, the correspondences become a perpetuum mobile. The result is necessarily, and has already been in Anastasi's research on the core group, an over-reading of the evidence carried out with, I continue to quote the introduction, the inflexible patience of a demented archivist, combined with a more than flexible roaming of the mind to establish new, one could say, rhizomatic connections. Research is the tool and it foregrounds what all research is, an exercise that involves personal preferences, one's own history, identities, and background knowledge. guiding the investigation and thus often self-fulfilling the hypotheses. In the words of the introduction, interpretation becomes art, and it provides a new way of reading all avant-garde literature. This does not only sound like a major accomplishment, it's paradigmatic. In order to show how far-reaching the impact of such a reading is and how central Jarry has indeed become, that is, in order to support Anastasia's hunch in the realm of art, art curation and history, I need to follow for a few minutes precisely the procedure to which Anastasia has inspired the Exegete's interpreters, and add some minor remarks to pataphysics, understood, among many other things, as the science of the particular. The nature of these investigations is such that both Anastasia and several of his interpreters of the highest caliber, the co-authors of this publication, have been prompted towards speculation and the anecdotal in order to capture the nature of that uncannily dense net of references, coincidences, and borrowings. In following on from this and in laying open some of these sort of docking stations between Anastasia, Jarry, universe, and my own projects and scholarly interests, I become implicated and cannot avoid, even if I wish to spin that dense web further. This enables me in the first instance to express gratitude for having been invited, or admitted, it seems, to the outskirts of this illustrious society by virtue of the kind invitation to speak here this afternoon, as well as Joseph Mashek's kind mentioning of my inclusion of Anastasia's Me in a Man Monophone in the exhibition Joyce in Art, Visual Art Inspired by James Joyce for last summer's Bloomsday Centenary in Dublin. In it, I presented and interpreted in the accompanying book visual interpretations of Joyce from the last 90 years. Anastasia's stunning Me in a Man Monophone installation was one of the key pieces in that exhibition, whose loan Aaron Levy and the Slough Foundation kindly facilitated. It was central not only because it illustrates brilliantly the research-based procedure of Joyce and the aesthetics of accumulated textual research, the long lists in both Ulysses and Finnegan's Wake, as well as the way in which Joyce addresses the echoes, the deep incrustations of time in the stacked materiality of his printed pages, as well as the lines on them. Anastasia also needed to be present to give company to yet another artist come Duchamp scholar, Eke Bonk, who designed that book that Jean-Michel showed to you a minute ago. Research and writing and their materiality became a focus. Most importantly, however, Me in a Man Monophone was indispensable because it is the closest precedent for or an eminent tradition in which I could place my own enterprise and its procedures. William Anastasia's universe has circled around Jarry for almost a half a century, and my own modest investigations into modernist and contemporary art have departed from Joyce, as opposed to Jarry, for almost 20 years now, giving me that demented archivist's perspective on art until I discovered that my thinking had become somewhat artistic, but more crucially, that this kind of dementia had been at the core of some artists' own explorations. Raymond Pettibon, who created some new drawings for Joyce in Art, called it the disease of reading Finnegan's Wake, making it impossible for him to read any text thereafter in any other than a microscopic Finnegan's Wake-inspired way. The text becomes ever more enmeshed in one's own course of learning and living, encouraging an idiosyncratic general as well as personalized knowledge. This observation is quite unoriginally not too far from Derrida's assertion that everything that happened to me, including the narrative that I would attempt to make of it, was already predicted and pre-narrated in Ulysses, to say nothing of Finnegan's Wake. This experience furthermore conjures what Jean-Michel Rabatier recounts in his recent publication, The Palgrave Advances in James Joyce Studies. It is an incident that I had not heard described before and that I love. A reader, one could also say a fan or a stalker, pestered Joyce, since he believed that the writer had cast a spell on himself and his family. He felt trapped in the work and implored Joyce to lift the spell, or else he would free himself by harming the writer. It is tempting to view Anastasi as a similar but positively cast and posthumous radical interpretive endeavor, as the introduction to the present book calls Anastasi's Jarrie Joyce Duchamp work. My attempt at seeing much of the history of contemporary art as a legacy of Joyce's writings may also carry a certain obsessive radicality. Obsession may not be the first word that comes to mind when considering the Joyce in Art exhibition that featured Me in a Man Monophone. It was, however, one that I would like to see in the tradition of thematic investigations in the medium of the contemporary visual art exhibition, a genre that was pioneered by Harald Seemann, the eminent Swiss curator. Seemann, who passed away a few months ago, called the sum total of his now prematurely concluded curatorial practice his museum of obsessions, and himself a cultural Gastarbeiter, a word that Steve McCaffrey uses in the Pataphysical Society. For Seemann, the adage artist-curator was coined, and his work is largely responsible for the strength of the curator's role in recent decades. One of his legendary exhibitions was entitled Bachelor Machines, testifying to his Duchampian credentials, and he wrote his PhD about none other than Alfred Jarrie. An extension of what William Anastasi has presented here, one cannot help but surmise that exhibition history and the history of curating are thoroughly and in their foundation, their very core, inspired by the French writer. As far as the history of art is concerned, the science of the particular and the obsessive approach of that demented archivist who moves between science and art immediately strike me as related to A.B. Warburg. When Jean-Michel Rabatier proposed Joyce the Egoist at the Zurich Joyce Conference in 1996, I attempted a Joycean iconography in paralleling the near contemporaries Joyce and Warburg. But the art historian with much closer contact to the writer who needs to be admitted to our society is no doubt Carola Gideon-Welker. The friend of the Joyces from 1928 had particularly seen in the writer's work the kinds of overarching and diachronic connections that are here the topic. She encouraged him to visit the stone alignments at Karnak and compared his procedures in an interdisciplinary way with visual artists like Constantin Brancusi, Max Ernst, and Kurt Schwitters. She moreover felt personally spellbound, if that is the right word, at first reading Ulysses, and said it had changed her life. A similar experience, then, underlies the book that she wrote about Alfred Jarrie in German in 1960. As I said, she is well known to have traced interdisciplinary connections, but Joyce only appears rarely in the Jarrie book, leaving the work to William Anastasi. As an aside, and further perpetuating the web of connections that is the topic of this publication and my topic here this evening, can I mention that I'm organizing a conference on Gideon-Welker for the Henry Moore Institute Leeds for next June. I already invited William Anastasi and would welcome any member of the Pataphysical Society. I would like to conclude with an observation parallel to the one with which I close my argument in Joyce and Art. It seems that we have reached a point where Joyce's legacy and Jarrie's as well as Anastasi's have produced clusters of connections and more indirect manifestations. Thomas McEvely has shown this elsewhere in tracing the many borrowings from Anastasi's work that have become canonical in minimalism and beyond. This society has penetrated visual culture in the broadest sense, making it virtually impossible to tell apart a direct use of Joyce or Jarrie or a subsequent interpretation of interpretations. Apart from the obvious statement that simulacra are central to postmodernism, there are further implications of this state of affairs for the work of artists, curators, and generally for practice and theory-based researchers. Anastasi is, to me, the prototypical practice-based researcher, a concept that is at the heart of third-level art education in the UK and that is gaining currency across the globe with practice-based PhDs and so forth. We will have to follow Anastasi ever further into the intricacies and peculiarities of his pataphysical science. Finnegan's wake reading groups and similar collaborative interpretive exercises are our home from home, and we are compelled to continue our work within the Pataphysical Society as obsessive readers, viewers, exhibition curators, and researchers. Thank you.
Just before introducing, and I don't think he needs to be introduced, William Anastasi, I'll just say that this book gives a faint equivalent of the beautiful exhibition, and that at the same time in Dublin you had this conference, which was interesting, but a little like the usual Joyce conferences, and then two places to visit that were extremely popular, the library with all the manuscripts of Joyce and a lot of new technology installed by an American couple, Luca Crispi and his wife. That was really extraordinary to see. And in the Joyce in Art exhibition, all the works of art that somehow gave an insight into the mind of Joyce and visual equivalents of what Finnegan's Wake can be like, and then standing out among these, the wall covered with writings by two walls indeed, it was an angle, which was a good way of going back to the library and then from the library coming back to the Hibernian Museum. So I don't know, Bill, this is very informal, but if you want to say a few words.
First, Aaron said if you wanted to say a few words, say a few words. And then when I got back from Pennsylvania after a week, I saw his email and it said, William Anastasi will speak, or something like that, much more formal. So I did write a paragraph this morning, and I... What came to mind was Alfred de Jarry's remark that life was such a brief inhalation. He described life as such a terribly brief inhalation. The poor guy was in love with drink. One of the chapters of his Faust role is titled Drink, in fact. When he can no longer afford absinthe, he turned to ether, and he left us when he was still in his mid-30s, I guess, something like that, 37 maybe, made it to, I'm not sure, maybe not quite 37, 34 maybe. Life is a brief inhalation, and what struck me about that was that I had learned that the first breath we take is an inhalation, which is the reverse of what you would think. I'm sorry, I made a mistake. He must have thought the first breath you take is an inhalation. I learned that the first breath you take is an exhalation. The inhaling, it's as though the universe is inhaling through us. Those who believe in God would go get quite flowery about this, but at the very least, it's as though whatever made millions of galaxies or whatever caused it is inhaling through us. So the inhalation is automatic. The exhalation you have to have strength for. Anyone who's had a serious pulmonary problem will be told by the doctor, don't worry about inhaling. Concentrate on exhaling. That's because you have to really gather your strength, if you're in that situation, to exhale. You need strength to exhale. And when you have inhaled automatically, as we all do, and you don't have the strength to exhale, then it's time to call the undertaker. So that interested me, that if you learn meditation, the most interesting form of meditation doesn't say merely pay attention to your breath. It goes further and says pay attention to your out-breath, to your exhalation. And to me, that means that somebody centuries ago noticed that a newborn baby, it's as though the whatever toxins are in the lungs have to be expelled before that first inhalation. And if the first thing you do is to exhale, someone must have thought, let's just concentrate on that, because that means life, and it's a good thing to concentrate on. Jerry loved chants. He deified chants. And one of the first connections with Joyce to me was an incident that Beckett wrote about. Well, Joyce made the remark himself that he said, I'm like a man walking along and my foot stumbles on something and I look down and it's exactly the thing I need. Now that, in a way, is deifying chants. And if you read Finnegan's Wake, you'll see it all over the place, even more than Ulysses. But Beckett told of when Joyce's eyes were bad, Beckett would take dictation. And Beckett, there was a knock on the door, and Joyce said, come in. But Beckett had not heard the knock on the door, and he thought it was part of the text of that Joyce was. So he wrote, "Come in." And later, when Joyce was listening, asked Beckett to read what he had said, so he could give it some other thoughts, perhaps. And he read, "Come in." And Joyce said, "What's that? Where did this come from? I didn't say come in." And Beckett said, "Yes, you said come in. I wouldn't have written it down if you didn't say come in." And then Joyce laughed because he remembered. He said, "Oh, I guess you didn't hear. I thought I heard a knock on the door, and I was responding to the knock when I said come in, and you must not have heard the knock, so you wrote come in." So they both laughed at that. And then Joyce said, "We'll read it again." And Beckett read it again with the accidental two words. And Joyce said, "Leave it. I like it. Leave it in." And to me, that's a great idea of life simply inserting itself into art and taking a chance occasion. And I learned that Singh, the man who wrote Rider to the Sea, used to eavesdrop through the floor. But Joyce, whether he got it from Singh or whether he figured it out himself, he loved to take dictation. He'd be at a party and he'd say, "I'm going to go to the bathroom," and he'd leave the room, and everyone would notice he didn't come back for a long time. And then once he was caught behind the door, slightly open, literally taking dictation. That's why the dialogue, particularly in Ulysses, is just so completely realistic. he's giving you dialogue that he heard, and in many cases it is verbatim. And it has that smack to it. So that's about 5 minutes. And I'm thrilled that you all came. And if anyone would like to ask me a question about how this came about, I'd be glad to ask. Otherwise, I guess I'm going to sit down here and I'm going to sign some books. And hope you enjoy it.